Is the water level rising? Are we just sinking? But first, our headlines. Before I dive in and pretend it hasn't been a few months since my last episode, I owe some of you an apology. Probably not you, the person listening to this, but maybe a few of you. I really only owe like 3 of you an apology. The rest of you, you can just subscribe to my podcast, and when I do eventually upload a new episode at some random, unforeseen time period, well, you can play it then. I can't really promise regular intervals of episodes or even a high production value. The best I can do is spend a few hours of research and editing on a topic that I've got interest in addressing. Don't get me wrong, I am so thankful that you are listening, and if time and money weren't constructs of our current reality, I have some really cool episodes planned. I really want to pull some sound bites and interview people and tell stories instead of just spew facts like I'm currently doing. But if I did all those things, it would quadruple the amount of time an episode takes. I'm just one man with a hobby to keep talking about the Bay, even after I have spent an entire day at my day job doing just that. So you have to bear with that. But a few of you have contacted me about getting your stickers after writing reviews for my podcast, and I clearly didn't have a good enough understanding of how Twitter mentions work and have never even seen it until today. So some of you even made a Twitter account just to message me about getting your sticker. I owe you folks big time, and I will send your sticker to whatever address you give me. Hell, I'll throw in some random stuff I see around the house, some random stickers, whatever, and I'll just throw it in there and I'll send it out to you. Just let me know. You can either email me at burtbaywide@gmail.com or find me on Twitter at burtbaywide, and I've made it set up so both of those things will alert my usual personal email whenever I'm contacted, all right? Anyway, I always make sure to update that Twitter with each episode after I finish one, as well as the meme that I haphazardly throw together for each episode too. Other than that, I probably don't check it too much, I'll be honest. But of course, if there's an article or topic that you want addressed on this show, just send it over to me. Again, that's burtbaywide@gmail.com and at burtbaywide on Twitter. I'm your host, Burt. Thanks for being part of Baywide. Also, if anyone wants a sticker that has a brilliant layout of the Chesapeake Bay outline, that is, with an equal sign, and next to the equal sign it says Bay, but not like B-A-Y, it says B-A-E. Get the wordplay? Anyway, all you have to do is write a review, send me your mailing address on either of those two methods of communication, and I got about 30 of them left, so the lettering, it's white, the background is blue, and they measure about, 2 inches by 3 inches, something like that, if that matters to you. All right, now on to the headlines, and thanks for being a listener. Our first article comes to us from the Bay Journal. Bay Journal, really awesome publication. You should definitely get it. It's free to subscribe. Anyway, it is entitled, Court Rules That DC's Daily E. Coli Limit is Inadequate. And that was written on October 8th. It's by Whitney Pipkin. And here is what it talks about. The U.S. District Court for the District of Columbia, they ruled at the end of this summer that the current limits set for E. coli aren't enough. Essentially, a lawsuit was filed back in 2016 by Earth Justice with support from the Anacostia Riverkeeper, Kingman Park Civic Association, and the Potomac Riverkeeper Network. And they all stated, when they sued the Environmental Protection Agency, that after the EPA approved DC's E. coli limits in 2014, they weren't actually doing it properly, or they were approving something that was higher than they should have. So the argument is that the EPA violated the Clean Water Act because when it accepted the limits DC proposed, they accepted the limits based on an equation that calculated the E. coli levels over a 30-day period instead of a total maximum daily load. And that's what the Clean Water Act demands. So to give you some more context, if a body of water is listed on an impaired waterways list, the Potomac River is on that list, the Anacostia River, the Chesapeake Bay itself is on that list. Anyway, if any body of water is on that list, they're really supposed to come up with a pollution diet, and that diet has an estimated total maximum daily load for like nutrients and pollutants and E. coli, and the whole purpose is this is the total maximum daily load of this particular thing, and we can have this much of it, and the water can still be considered healthy. So they set E. coli as a total maximum daily load of how much E. coli can be present in the water. You can still have a healthy waterway. So when DC, they're tasked with coming up with it because they're dealing with the Anacostia and Potomac rivers, which flow through their jurisdiction. So they have to come up with their E. coli limits. Now, when they're coming up with this, they use an equation that allowed for a high level of E. coli within a 24-hour period. Say, after a really big rain event, you get a lot of poop that goes out into the waterway. So that's got elevated E. coli levels. So anyway, as long as the long-term average of 30 days was lower, then you could actually have a high level, like higher than their limit in a 24-hour period. So that would not really meet the definition of a total maximum daily load. You know, total maximum daily load, this is your cap limit for each day. Whereas the way DC calculated it, it was like, yeah, I mean, you could have higher on one day, but as long as like the long-term average is lower, it's okay. That's basically what DC said. And you know, the reason that we care about E. coli is because it's a bacteria that is commonly found in fecal matter. So the Potomac River and the Anacostia River, those are largely urban areas around DC. And that is where Blue Plains treatment plant is, like the world's largest wastewater treatment plant is. Before they started doing this huge retrofit, like building tunnels, basically these tunnels were just to shelter or hold all the wastewater after rain events so it could treat it instead of just releasing that raw sewage into the waterways. Before they did that, there was a huge problem with it. And really, there still is a big problem, and not just in DC, but everywhere, with E. coli and wastewater treatment plants just having to release that sewage when they have combined systems. Anyway, I think I've talked about that in years past. But that is why we care about E. coli. And it's not really because E. coli is like the worst bacteria ever. It's just a really good indicator for other pathogens that could be present, right? So the courts agreed with Earthforce, and they gave DC regulators a year to create new limits that would meet the total maximum daily load definitions more properly. All right, cool. Next headline, the James River. James River got a really impressive international award for the cleanup effort that it's been undertaking over the past like 40 years. And it won the International River Prize at the International River Symposium. And maybe they could just throw a river in there one more time, but that was in Brisbane, Australia. And it is done by the International River Foundation. They give the award to remarkable outcomes for rivers, river basins, and their communities. And that prize is considered the most coveted award of river and watershed restoration accomplishments. And the James River went from one of the nation's most polluted rivers to one that has been consistently rated as the healthiest major tributary to Chesapeake Bay by the University of Maryland. The James River Association actually applied for this award, and they do a lot of management for the area. They also do a State of the James report card every couple of years, and that shows kind of the health grade of the James River. It used to be a low D, and now it's a B minus as of 2019. And this is actually the first time that a river from the Mid-Atlantic has been selected as an award winner. The award comes with $200,000 Australian cash and the opportunity to network with other, you know, river managers around the world. Previous winners of this award include the Thames in England, the Rhine in Europe, the Maria in Kenya, the Charles in Massachusetts, and most recently the San Antonio in Texas. And you know, while we're on the topic of the James River, there was also a headline just last week about the James and how it is having a pretty high amount of algae bloom compared to usual in that river. What scientists were saying is basically because we've had about a month-long drought before this. I mean, I know I was just saying, oh, it's been so wet. But you know, just the past month has been about a month-long drought. And that means there was less flow in the James River and really a higher than average temperatures. And so it was just like a breeding ground for those algae blooms that usually get washed out towards the Chesapeake Bay. They just weren't getting washed out. The flow wasn't high enough. So there's been like record high algae blooms in the James River for the past month. I'm not saying it's, you know, they're going to take away their B minus. I'm just saying that's just what happened in the past month or so. But, you know, we're already getting big rain events and I'm sure we'll be good to go from here on out. All right, and our last headline has to do with the Chesapeake Bay oyster fishery. And really, I probably should have done less headlines because this is like taking way too long. But a lot's been happening in the Bay. It's been a couple months since I've done a podcast. I'm just trying to catch you guys up. I really think this is the most important thing currently happening, and it's the reduction in the oyster limits by the state of Maryland for this season. Now, if you want to pay the Baltimore Sun a visit, read their September article entitled Maryland Relaxes Initially Proposed Oyster Harvest Limits, Aims for 26% Reduction. Maybe I should stop reading environmental news headlines on the show because they're not very sexy. Anyway, the oyster season is the first one after the state oyster stock assessment, which happened last year. And I mentioned it in the show before, but here's a quick recap of what that oyster stock assessment said about the state of the oyster fishery. It did a bunch of fancy computer models to estimate the market size oyster, and it found that in the Maryland portion of Chesapeake Bay, the model suggested that despite our many attempts at oyster restoration in the past decade, we're still experiencing a net loss of oysters. In 1999, we had an estimated 600 million market size oyster, while in 2018, it's estimated that there are only about 300 million market size oysters. And although the history of oystering has been long and complicated in the Bay, the concept of sustainability is not that complicated. My professor used to say that being more sustainable was like being more pregnant. You either are or you aren't. And this halving of the oyster population in 20 years, that's not sustainable, right? So after a lot of back and forth and debates between the Waterman Association, the Department of Natural Resource scientists, tons of other stakeholders and environmentalists, the oyster season, this season, will try to limit how many oysters are coming out of the bay by 26% compared to last year. And originally that proposal was going to be 30% reduction, and they were going to cut the season shorter by about 10 days in October and 10 days in March. But that didn't happen. Here's a really concise breakdown of what actually is happening this oyster season. And I don't really have any information on like how it's going because really the season just started. So the season started October 1st for commercial diving and tonguing, and that season will end on March 31st. The season for power dredging has not started yet. That runs from November 1st and it goes to March 31st. And really a big reason why the season didn't get cut short by 10 days here is because watermen argued that they would have lost their markets during the Thanksgiving holiday. Also, a new addition for this year, there's no commercial harvest allowed on Wednesdays, so you can't go out on Wednesday at all. So that means oystering is confined to 4 days out of the week instead of the usual five. There's also a reduction in how many bushels you can take out on a daily basis. So this season, you can only have 10 bushels caught a day per person, or you can have up to 20 bushels per day on a boat if like you and another oysterman are doubling up on your licenses. Last season, the limit was 12 bushels per day or 24 bushels per boat. Also, several of the oyster reefs that are north of the Chesapeake Bay Bridge, they'll be closed until much later in the season. From what I understand, that is being done because of how fresh the water has been in the upper bay, and that's prevented many of the oysters from growing. Lastly, the recreational harvest is limited to 3 days a week, and there's a 50% reduction in harvest limits. So last season, the limit was a bushel per day for recreation. So I suppose it means that this time it's a half bushel per day. But you still don't need to have a special like license to walk out and grab an oyster recreationally. Anyway, will that be enough? Like, will 26% be enough of a reduction? Is it actually going to be 26% based off of these numbers? You know, the state said they wanted to make the oyster fishery sustainable in 8 to 10 years from now. But in my esteemed and honest opinion, I surely doubt that that is possible in such a short amount of time. And I think the Maryland officials know that too. It's kind of like the same people that have been saying they want to make the Inner Harbor of Baltimore swimmable by 2020. Like, could we be a little bit more realistic, folks? All right, so that concludes our headlines. Let's get on to the big topic that we're going to be talking about, which is land subsidence. And really, why is sea level rise so much worse here in the Chesapeake region than it is going to be anywhere else on the entire Atlantic seaboard? So the entire concept of sea level rise is one that I don't think I'll be able to clear up in just one day in a couple minutes. And I'll just be focusing on one component of sea level rise in the Chesapeake Bay region. I'm sure you're all aware of why the seas are slowly but surely rising as our oceans are warming, the water molecules expand, which then makes the water take up more room, ergo higher water levels. But you know, besides thermal expansion, we're obviously having a rapid increase in melting land-based ice like glaciers and ice sheets. And so when that melted ice, that water goes into the ocean itself that didn't used to be there, the ocean absorbs this newly added water. There's more water than before that makes sea levels rise. So the global sea level in 2014 was 2.6 inches higher than it was in 1993. That's a stat from NOAA, National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. If you want to learn more about sea level rise, NOAA is a great resource. And that's where I pulled these figures. And just keep in mind that these stats I just gave, they're a reflection of the global sea level. Relative sea level trends vary by location. And it just so happens that Chesapeake Bay area is one of the worst places in the country for sea level rise. It's going to be worse here. It's already worse here. It'll continue to be worse here. And it's a variety of reasons that are responsible for that. It goes from like the way our infrastructure is built, because our land is already so close to sea level. It's not much difference in altitude here. And we had change in ocean currents, temperatures, a lot of reasons. But the reason I'll be talking about today is the fact that the land is sinking. So if you want to take a look at any of the research used for this episode, I had quite a bit of reports and models and weather station data compiled to look at, and it was all done by U.S. Geological Survey, a bunch of universities, government agencies. They all did an excellent job, and actually, there's some really good charts and figures, even artfully done illustrations describing these concepts, particular accommodation to the U.S. Geological Survey. So just want to give a shout out to them, and you can look at all these like multiple page PDFs if you just kind of look in the show notes. So the gist here is that in some parts, not all, but some parts of the Bay Area, it's sinking, or a technical term, it's subsiding. And most of the places that this is happening are on the Eastern Shore and the Southern Chesapeake region. That land has been siding for two particular reasons. The land is literally rebounding, kind of like a seesaw from the last glacial period. So that's one big one. The other one is the aquifers have been pumped at rates of 1.5 millimeters to 3.5 millimeters a year. And that lack of water where there used to be water has led to the ground compacting on itself. So when groundwater is pumped from an aquifer system, that pressure decreases. That pressure change is reflected by the water levels in the wells. Now, when the water levels decrease, the aquifer system pressure decreases, and that's happening over most of the southern Chesapeake Bay region, with the greatest water level decreases seen near the pumping centers of Franklin and West Point, Virginia. As water levels decrease, the aquifer system compacts. This causes the land surface above it to subside, and water levels have decreased over the entire Virginia coastal plain. Potomac Aquifer, which is the deepest and thickest aquifer in the southern Chesapeake Bay region, and it supplies about 75% of groundwater, was drawn from the entire Virginia coastal plain aquifer system. The amount of aquifer system compaction is determined by three factors, really. It's the water level decline, the sediment compressibility, you know, how easy is it to compress this type of sediment that we have, and then like how thick is the sediment itself. And if any of these three factors increase in magnitude, then the amount of the aquifer system compaction and land subsistence increases. Now, because all three of these factors vary a lot across the entire southern Chesapeake Bay region, the rates of land subsistence, caused by the aquifer system compaction also vary. The Virginia coastal plain aquifer consists of many stacked layers of like sand and clay, and although groundwater is withdrawn primarily from the aquifers, the sandy layers, most of the compaction occurs in the confining unit, like the clay lenses. That's the relatively impermeable layers. They're sandwiched between and within the aquifers. This compression of the clay layers is mostly non-recoverable, meaning if the groundwater levels later recover, like we recharged our groundwater system, you know, didn't take as many out, let them kind of naturally fill back up, the aquifer system still would not expand to its previous volume, and the land surface would not rise to its previous elevation. Whew, that was some nerdy science, and I feel like I was a bit condescending when I was like reading it. So, you know, apologies, I wasn't trying to be condescending. There was also a lot more science, like nerdy fine clay versus sand and like millimeter measurements and all this stuff that I purposely left out. But I still feel like I was too condescending in the way I described that, so I'll try to do a little bit less of that. Anyway, the important thing to note here is that this compaction, it accounts for about half of the observed land subsidence in the region. So about half of it is from us just pumping out so much water out of the aquifers and that land kind of settling on top of where that water used to be. And again, this is like the same problem that's happening all over the country. There's two really well-studied cases of land subsidence there in like the Houston, Galveston area, and also the Santa Clara Valley of California. And land sank there by as much as like 3 meters over 50 years because of that intensive groundwater withdrawals in the areas, as well as like petroleum extraction in Texas. So you had a result in increased coastal flooding and things like that. So like, nothing new, but also, you know, cause for concern for sure. And I've always thought of the entire Mid-Atlantic region as just being like an oasis of water, right? We have so much water everywhere. So it's kind of surprising to learn that half of the reason our land is sinking is just we're taking too much water faster than our groundwater aquifers can recharge. Next up, the other half of the equation of our land sinking is glacial isostatic adjustment. So we have this crystalline bedrock that underlays all of our layered sediments of the Virginia coastal plain aquifer system. And that bedrock, it's not really solid. It's not totally unyielding. No, it flexes and it moves in response to stress. So bedrock in the Mid-Atlantic region moving really slowly downward, and that's in response to the melting of the Laurentide ice sheet that covered Canada and the northern United States during the last ice age. And when that ice sheet still existed, the weight of all that ice, right, just so much weight, so glacier, all built up in one place, that pulled the underlying Earth's crust downward, pushing down on the crust there. We're talking like New York, Canada area. And that weight, it was pushing that crust down. Well, that crust is the same crust that's connected down in the Virginia area. So it's just like a seesaw. You're pushing down on one area, it's pushing up on the other area. So Virginia and Maryland area and the Bay area, it got higher. And keep in mind, this is even before the Chesapeake Bay was formed, right? The Chesapeake Bay formed because these glaciers melted and it filled in the Susquehanna River. But this is even before that happened, right? The bay was formed like 10, 11,000 years ago. The ice started melting. That ice sheet started melting about 18,000 years ago. And it took many thousands of years to disappear entirely. And as that ice melted, its weight was removed. So that glacial forebridge areas, which previously had been forced upward, they began sinking. And they continue to sink today. Just like a seesaw, you remove the weight, it's kind of balancing itself back out, right? This movement of the Earth's crust in response to ice loading and melting, it's called glacial isostatic adjustment. And data from GPS measurements and carbon dating of marsh sediments indicate that the regional land subsidence in response to glacial isostatic adjustment in the whole Southern Bay area, it's going at about a current rate of 1 millimeter a year. And this downward velocity, it's kind of uncertain, and it's definitely not uniform across the region, but you could probably say about 1 millimeter a year. So again, you got these two things working, not quite in tandem, but you know, they're happening at the same time. And as far as the aquifer system that we've been pumping out, which is responsible for about half, 53% or so of our land subsidence in the southern Chesapeake Bay region, the average measured land subsidence rates are about 2.8 millimeters a year to 2.6 millimeters a year. And then you got the isostatic rebound of the glaciers. Wide, it's about 1 millimeter a year. But, you know, it varies as much as like 2 to 3 in other parts too. So put it all together, you have about half of our land subsidence is from pumping out the wells. And then just under half is from the glacial isostatic rebound since the last glacial period, right? And so this is just the land sinking. This has nothing to do with the sea level rise that's happening due to like climate change, but obviously the relative sea level rise in the Bay region, even if there wasn't climate change, would be increasing because the land is sinking. So relative sea level rise measured by the National Oceanic Administration, they have tidal stations all over the Bay, and they're averaging about 3.9 millimeters a year from 1950 to 2006. And so science have forecasted that by about 2050, we'll see an increase of about 2 feet in the Chesapeake Bay. And then that number could be about as high as 3.7 feet by 2100. So now you know a little bit about land subsidence in the Southern Bay region and just the Bay area as a whole. And you also know that there's always more to a factor figure than just like, oh, this is going to happen by this year. There's so many variables always interplaying with each other. So just remember that whenever you're looking at data sets. And I'm sure I didn't even go through as many as I should have to give you the stats that I did today. So keep that in mind too. You know, I'm not a total expert. I just learned about this stuff in college, teach about it on occasion, and then, you know, a couple hours of research. So if you have any ideas for the show, please let me know. Okay, why? All right, welcome. It has been a while since I have created the Chesapeake Bay meme, and I think I was up for the challenge this time. And you know what it's going to be about? It's going to be about land subsidence, obviously. But here is what I did. I went and I searched for a seesaw meme that really spoke to me. Couldn't really find any good ones, but then I did see a still image of a SpongeBob SquarePants episode where he's on a seesaw with, it looks like just a bubble. Honestly, I'm going to actually have to admit to you that I hadn't seen this episode. And it's like him on a seesaw. He's at the bottom of the seesaw looking up at this bubble thing. The bubble thing's got its back to you, but he's kind of transparent. It's almost like he's going to pop any second. He's at the top of the seesaw. And SpongeBob, being at the bottom of the seesaw, he is looking up and he's kind of like freaked out. He's like, uh-oh, what's about to happen? It's almost like this bubble said something that caught him off guard. It's like an M. Night Shyamalan kind of twist, you know? Anyway, that's the meme I used. And I don't even think this meme is in circulation. Yeah. I used an original meme format for my original meme about Lamb Sidons and Sea Level Rise. Whew, get on this nerd level, son. Anyway, here's the text. You can find it again at Burt Bay White if you go to Twitter. It says at the very top, it says, when you notice the glacier is gone, right? So that kind of explains SpongeBob's look when he's looking up and says, oh my gosh, the glacier's about to go. Then the bottom text right under the seesaw says, and you about to experience glacial isostatic rebound. Boom, right? Because like, that glacier dude at the top, he's just gonna float away or bubble pop or whatever, and then SpongeBob's gonna be left just kind of soaring up to equilibrium, so he's not ready for it. Hence the meme, when you notice the glacier is gone and you're about to experience glacial isostatic rebound. Oh, right. Guys, that was probably, I mean, I'm not saying I have a good repertoire here or, you know, catalog of memes, but this is not a bad one. I mean, it's not funny, but it's not bad, you know? All right, I'll see you, maybe in a week, maybe in 2 months. But anyway, subscribe. Bye.